and then Tom walked off too. He thought about going after Eleanor and resuming the discussion, but couldn't find the energy. And he was afraid, too, more of what he would say than she. On the way back to his compartment, he heard laughter drifting up from the lower level of his sleeping car. Laughs. He could use some right now. He hurried down the stairs and headed right, following the sounds. These were less expensive sleeping accommodations, smaller than his and with no shower, but each compartment had a toilet and a drop-down sink. At the end of the corridor, he saw Regina and the tarot card lady standing outside one compartment and talking with someone inside the space. Regina saw him and waved him over. When he walked up, he saw that there was an older woman sitting on a seat in the compartment. Then he noticed the wheelchair folded up and placed against the facing chair situated against the other wall. He turned and studied the tarot card lady. She still wore her multicolored headdress, but she'd taken off the dumbbell shoes and was in slippers. That made her about 4 inches shorter, and she turned out to be rather petite. Up close, she had intensely luminous blue eyes filled with both mischief and charm, and a warm smile. He noted that the compartment across the hall had a brightly colored beaded door where the curtain had been pulled back and secured. He also thought he smelled incense, although he assumed that would be strictly against Amtrak policy. "I'm assuming those are your digs," he said to her.
"Why, Mr. Langdon, you have psychic powers of your own," she said with a throaty laugh.
"How did you..." He stopped and looked at Regina. "Okay, no aliens need apply. You told her."
Regina said, "Meet Drusilla Pardo, Tom, and you don't have to tell Drusilla anything. She already knows it."
Drusilla put out a dainty hand.
"My good friends call me Misty, and I already know that we're going to be good friends, so you just go ahead and call me that."
Misty had a southern accent augmented by something a little spicier. "New Orleans?" he said.
"By way of Baltimore. Very good, Tom."
She drew closer to him, and he concluded that the incense smell was actually Misty's perfume.
"Misty used to be a CPA there in Baltimore," said Regina. "I found I had a gift for numbers, and gifts should be used for a higher purpose than the avoidance of taxes, don't you think, Tom?"
"Undoubtedly."
"You're right. He is cute, Regina," said the wheelchair lady.
She was just finishing up her dinner, which was on a tray in front of her.
"I didn't know there was room service on this train," said Tom, smiling. "I had to schlep to the dining car."
"Oh, sure," said the lady, returning the smile. "You just need one of these things, and Regina will bring your meal right to you."
She pointed to her wheelchair.
"Where are my manners?" said Regina. "Lynette Monroe, Tom Langdon."
Lynette was about 65, with long silver hair and elegant features, still a very attractive woman. She seemed full of good spirits despite her disability.
"I hear you're working with those film people, Tom," said Regina.
"Is that really Max Powers?" asked Lynette. "I love his pictures."
"That woman with them," said Regina. "On the passenger list, it said Eleanor Carter, but I think she's really a movie star or something, traveling, you know, incognito. That lady has class, and she's drop-dead gorgeous. Is she a movie star, Tom?"
"Actually, I know her, and she's a writer, not an actress, although I wouldn't disagree with you about the classy part or the drop-dead gorgeous thing."
Her sanity, however, was not something he could vouch for right now.
"You knew her, like before today?"
"Yes, years ago. We did some reporting together."
"I heard it was a little more than that," said Misty.
Tom stared at her. "What do you know about it?"
"Word travels faster on a train than anywhere else except maybe church. People overhear things, you know."
She drew even closer to Tom.
"Such tight quarters and everything."
"You mean people eavesdrop," he said.
"Well, that's a less polite way of putting it. My motto is, if you don't have anything good to say about someone, come find Misty and tell her all about it."
"I have to go now, ladies," he said, gently disengaging himself from Misty. Regina picked up Lynette's tray.
"Me too."
As they walked off,
Misty called out, "Oh, Tom!"
He turned back and she fanned out her tarot cards.
"I just have this little premonition that we are connected somehow."
"Misty, he has a girlfriend in L.A. he's going to visit for Christmas," said Regina. "She does the voice for Cuppy the Magic Beaver on TV."
Tom stared at her, stunned. "How do you know that?"
"Agnes Jo told me."
Tom looked at the women, exasperated. "With you two, what do we need the CIA for?"
"Now, Tom," drawled Misty, "a grown man needs a grown woman. Cartoons can't keep you warm at night, sweetie."
"That Misty is a piece of work," Tom said to Regina after they had climbed the stairs. Regina smiled.
"Oh, she's just Southern friendly is all. She doesn't mean any of it. Well, at least not all of it. We're good friends."
"I take it she rides the trains a lot."
"Oh, yeah, she tells people their fortune, reads their palms, does the card thing, all for free. She usually takes the Crescent train out to D.C. right on to New Orleans. Has a little shop in the French Quarter just off Jackson Square. I've been there. It's cool."
"And Lynette? That was nice of you to take her food."
"Well, trains aren't easy to get around in a wheelchair. She has MS, but she never lets it get her down. We have a great time."
"You really seem to get to know your passengers."
"They mean a lot to me. Actually..."
"You little thief!"
They looked up, and there was Gordon Merriweather.
"Excuse me?" said Regina.
Merriweather stomped toward them.
"I've been robbed, and I'm betting you did it. In fact, you're the only one who could have done it. I'll have your job, and you'll be spending Christmas in prison," he roared.
"Hold on," said Regina. "I don't appreciate your tone or your accusation. If you're missing something, I'll take a report and we'll file it with the proper authorities."
"Don't read me the little speech," snapped Merriweather. "I want my things back, and I want them back right now."
"Well, since I don't know what those things are or who took them, that would be a little difficult, sir."
Tom stepped between them. "Look, Gord, I'm not a big-time lawyer like you, but I do know that people are innocent until proven guilty. Now, unless you have direct evidence of who took your stuff, then you're slandering this woman in front of a witness, and that can be a costly thing, as I'm sure you know."
Merriweather eyed him.
"What do you know about slander?"
"Name's Tom Langdon. I'm an investigative reporter. Won a Pulitzer, in fact. I wrote one story about an American lawyer in Russia who was doing some really bad things. He's currently writing his own appellate briefs in prison. And if I found one thing that's even mightier than legal papers filed in court, it's a story in the newspaper that the whole world can dig their teeth into."
Merriweather took a step back and then snapped at Regina. "My Palm Pilot, $200 in cash, and my Tag Heuer watch. I want them back before I get off this train in Chicago, or heads will roll." He stalked off.
Both Tom and Regina let out long breaths.
"That guy is a trip," said Tom.
"Maybe he heard Max Powers is on board and he's auditioning to play Scrooge."
"My mother taught me to love everybody, but she never met Gordon Merriweather."
"I take it you've run into him before."
"Everybody who works on this train has," she paused.
"Thanks, Tom. Thanks a lot."
"Hey, you would have done okay all by yourself."
"Did you really win a Pulitzer?"
"No, actually I won two."
"Wow, that's impressive."
"Not really. All you have to do is spend your life running from one awful place to another, write about every horrible thing you see. The civilized world reads about it, then forgets it, but pats you on the head for doing it and gives you a reward as appreciation for changing nothing." He walked off to his compartment to get some sleep.
Chapter 15. Eleanor went directly to her compartment, closed and locked the door, and drew the privacy curtain. She sat down slowly on the bed, which Regina had made up during the mealtime. She flicked the light off and sat there in the dark. She could now look outside and watch the snow coming down even harder. It didn't bother the cap much. The train seemed to be going at full tilt. They flashed by clusters of modest houses and then dense woods and the occasional creek cutting through the earth. Smoke curled from the chimneys of the homes, seeming to write secrets in the tangle of snowfall, messages Eleanor couldn't decipher.
Her fingers moved across the cold glass, marking her own intricate symbols on the smooth surface. She began to softly cry, placing her head against the pillow Regina had placed in the corner, her body curling up in despair. As she looked out the window, in her mind's eye, the landscape changed dramatically. As Tom had earlier, she was now transported to Tel Aviv over Christmas. She'd been so happy and yet so miserable there that the schizophrenic quality of her existence had come close to driving her insane. And maybe it had on that Christmas morning when her future with a man she loved had disappeared. She still remembered so vividly how she'd looked back at him as she was heading up the escalator at the airport and how he'd simply turned away and left her. At that memory, the tears started to spill, and the tight control with which she'd come to lead her life eroded to nothing. She'd thought him incapable of doing this to her ever again, and yet he had, with no more than a look and a word or two. She was helpless. There was a knock on her door, and she tensed. She wasn't ready to see him again, not right now, possibly not ever.
Eleanor, you're not sleeping, are you?
She'd been holding her breath, and she let it out in relief. It was Max, not Tom. Just a minute. She put on the lights, wiped her face with a wet towel, and reached for her brush to swipe at her hair. However, her brush wasn't where she had left it. She ran her fingers through her hair instead and opened the door. Max quickly stepped in and closed the door behind him.
You okay? You don't look very good.
Probably just tired.
Well, it's all set up, the wedding stuff. I talked with the Amtrak folks. They had no problem with it.
That's wonderful, Eleanor said quietly.
So, how's it going with Tom? You guys getting some good stuff?
Great material. I'll be putting some notes together soon.
It's that pioneer spirit. You don't take a train because you want to get somewhere fast. You take it for the journey itself, to be surprised.
Well, I've certainly been surprised on this trip. He looked at her tenderly.
Life is full of funny coincidences. I went to get some lunch at Paolo's once, you know, that really expensive Italian place over near Rodeo Drive. Well, I walk in and who's there? Not one, not two, but all three of my ex-wives.
That's amazing. They were all there separately?
Oh, no. Apparently they meet every Tuesday and talk about how awful I was to be married to. Sort of like a book club, only its purpose is to crucify yours truly. Of course, they never mention that the alimony I pay each of them allows them to sit on their fashionably dressed derrieres in a five-star restaurant for 4 hours and complain about me.
He looked at her. You want to tell me about this Langdon fellow? If you ask me, it seems you two were a lot more than reporting colleagues. Eleanor nervously played with her hands. Do you remember when we first started working together? You asked me what made me want to write, what power drove me?
Sure, I remember. I ask all my writers that.
Well, Tom Langdon is the answer to that question.
I don't understand.
I loved him, Max. Loved him with everything I had to give. When it ended, there was this void, this hole in me as large as a dead star. The only outlet I had was the written word.
Lucky for me, not so good for you, Max said quietly. So you loved him. He clearly still cares for you. What happened?
She stood up and paced in the small area while he watched. She finally said, two people can care for each other but not want the same things. Then it doesn't work, no matter how much you love each other.
So what does Tom want?
I'm not sure he even knows. I know what he doesn't want, to be tied down anywhere or by anyone.
And do you know what you want?
Who knows, Max? Who really knows what they want?
Well, I guess I'm not the best person to ask. My interests keep changing. But I guess that's part of life. Maybe to be happy. Maybe that's what we're all looking for. And we find it in lots of different ways.
If you find it. Many people never do, and maybe I'm one of them.
Eleanor, you're a smart, talented, successful, beautiful woman in the prime of your life.
And maybe that woman doesn't need a man in her life to be complete, she said.
He shrugged. Maybe not. I'm not saying everybody has to be married to be happy.
So what are you saying?
The director rose. I'm just saying don't assume you don't need someone in your life to be happy either.
Max left and went to Cristobal's compartment, where he observed his assistant tearing his room apart.
"What are you doing?" asked Max.
"Looking for my sunglasses."
"Sunglasses? Look out the window. It's nighttime."
"I mean they're missing."
"So buy another pair."
"These cost $400.
Max looked at him intently.
"Exactly how much do I pay you, Cristobal?"
The young man swallowed hard and eyed his boss nervously.
"I saved up for a whole year to buy them."
"Uh-huh. Look, the wedding is a go."
"Terrific, sir. You're a genius."
"So you keep telling me. Now, you've got your assignments. I don't want any screw-ups."
"When have I ever let you down, Mr. Powers?"
"I know, but see, nobody's that good. And I just don't want the first time you do fail to be this time, okay?"
"I understand, sir."
"You're a good kid, but when we get to L.A., I'm cutting your pay."
"Why, sir?" asked an astonished Cristobal.
"Because even I don't spend $400 on sunglasses, that's why."
Tom lay on his bed and studied the underside of the bunk above him. He'd fallen asleep for a while, but was now wide awake. He got up and took out his notebook, but couldn't find his pen. He searched everywhere, but it wasn't in his compartment. The pen had significant meaning to him. Eleanor had given it to him when they'd first gone overseas together. He finally gave up, and hearing music, stepped into the corridor. The song was coming from Agnes Joe's compartment. The door was open and the light on. He moved to the threshold and cautiously peeked in. Agnes Joe was seated, fully dressed, and on the fold-down table next to her was an old phonograph she'd plugged into the outlet. He recognized the song. It was Silent Night. Agnes Joe looked up, saw him, and seemed a little embarrassed at being discovered.
"I hope the music isn't disturbing you."
"Hey, what better than Christmas carols during Christmas week? Singing with Tyrone puts me in the mood. I bring this little phonograph with me everywhere I go. It belonged to my mother. You're welcome to come on in and listen."
He hesitated for just a moment, but then sat down on the couch. The woman looked like she could use some company. She eyed him keenly.
"Regina told me how you helped her out with the nasty lawyer. You did a good deed tonight, Tom. Played guardian angel." "Well, they say there are more guardian angels during the Christmas season than at any other time."
"I've never heard that. Did you just make that up?"
"Actually, I did, I think."
"It's a nice thought, though."
They sat and listened to several more uplifting carols. The compartment smelled of lilac soap and was very neat. Tom noted a very full duffel bag wedged in between the chair and the wall, with a blanket partially covering it. When he looked up, Agnes Joe was staring intently at him, a look of sadness on her face. Just then a family of four, Mom, Dad, and two children, passed down the corridor. They were laughing, and the boy did a little jig and almost fell down.
"Trains are nice over Christmas. People are in good moods. It's really a great way for families to travel together," said Agnes Joe.
"So how come you're not spending Christmas with your family?"
"A girl has to be asked to the party, doesn't she?"
"So you and your daughter don't get along?"
"I get along fine with her. She seems to have a problem with me."
"I'm sorry, Agnes Joe. I really am."
"I've got lots of friends on the train, though."
"Like that lady in the lounge car said, friends are friends, but family is family."
She smiled.
"Pauline the knitter? What does she know about anything? And that was the ugliest sweater I've ever seen."
She paused and said,
"I say that your family is where you find it. You just have to look like you."
"What do you mean, like me?"
"That film lady, Eleanor. She's the Eleanor from your past, isn't she? The one love of your life."
"We're not even friends now."
"But you could be, and a lot more."
He shook his head. "No, too late."
"You're wrong there."
Ignoring his puzzled look, she said,
"I've seen enough in this world to know that two people who can make each other that miserable must love each other a lot."
He thanked her for the musical interlude and went back to his compartment. However, he didn't intend to waste his time on something that clearly would never happen. He'd lost Ellie once, and it had devastated him. The aftershock still pounded him all these years later. He was never going to chance being that hurt again. The past was dead. Resurrection out of the question. he had reconciled himself to this fate when Father Kelly popped his head in.
"You haven't seen a silver cross lying around, have you?"
"Why, did you lose one?"
"Well, I can't seem to find it."
"That's strange. I'm missing a pen."
The priest shrugged and walked off as Tom's cell phone rang. He checked his watch and saw it was after midnight. He clicked the phone's answer button.
"Hello," he said.
It was Lelia calling from L.A.
"I've been tracking you on the Internet. According to the schedule, you're in Pittsburgh, right?"
Tom looked out the window. The train was slowing, and he was trying to see a station sign. A few moments later, he saw it. Connellsville, Pennsylvania. They were far from Pittsburgh. They must have stopped again while he'd been asleep.
"So you're in Pittsburgh, right?"
she asked again.
"Yep, you can see the stadium from here. Remember those great Steeler teams of the 70s?
"I don't follow baseball. I just know you're supposed to be in Pittsburgh."
"The Steelers are a football team, and do you realize it's after midnight my time?"
"You can't possibly be sleeping on the train. Isn't it far too noisy and bumpy?"
"Actually, it's a very nice ride, and I was sleeping," he lied.
"You can set up right over there, Eric,"
Lelia said to someone.
"Eric? Who's Eric?" asked Tom.
"He's my FBTT.
FBTT sounds like a disease.
Full body therapeutic technician. It's all the rage out here now."
"Oh, I'm sure it is. So what is old Eric going to do for you in the privacy of your own home?"
"My lower back, hamstrings, and he's going to give me a pedicure, too."
"Lower back and hamstrings? Anything in between those points?"
"What?"
"Are you clothed during this process?"
"Don't be silly. I have a towel on."
"Oh, gee, that's a relief. Look, why do you need this guy to come to your house to do all this? I thought you belonged to that fancy spa."
"My back was hurting, and my toenails really need some emergency work. I'm wearing open-toed high heels tomorrow."
"Yeah, I guess that does qualify as a crisis. So why not try a hot water bottle and nail clippers? That seems to work for the rest of America."
"I'm not the rest of America."
"How do you know this, Eric?"
"He's my kickboxing instructor. He's an FBTT on the side."
While there were many legitimate kickboxing enthusiasts, when Tom had gone to one of her kickboxing sessions in L.A., he had found it inhabited mostly by accountants, lawyers, actors, and chefs who paraded around in designer spandex, flailing at rubber bad guys with their feet and fists. Two or three modestly rowdy kindergartners could have vanquished the whole lot of them.
"The 6'4" blonde-haired, blue-eyed Adonis guy from Sweden, that's Eric? That guy is in your house right now while you're in a tiny towel?"
"Jealousy. I like that. It's healthy for a relationship. And Eric is Norwegian."
"Fine. Could you put Norway Eric on, please?"
"Why?"
"I'd like to make an appointment with him for when I'm out there. I think my back is going to need some work after this train ride. I'm assuming he does both women and men."
"Yes, he does. But you have to promise you won't be mean. I know how you can get sometimes. Promise?"
"Absolutely. Hey, my back is hurting, and I like a little FBTT as much as the next person."
He heard her passing the phone over with some words of explanation.
"Yeah, this is Eric. May I help you?"
came the voice of the Norwegian Adonis.
"Eric, Tom Langdon, before I make an appointment, I was just wondering if you have an infectious disease disclosure policy."
"Excuse me, this thing I do not know."
"Infectious disease disclosure policy. It's all the rage everywhere, except possibly where you are. Let me explain it in really simple terms. Since you work with people's bodies, like Lelia in the towel there, and you come in contact with human skin, you run the risk of being infected with some serious and contagious diseases, which you could then potentially pass on to other clients like me. So I wanted to know what safety precautions you take, and also what disclosure procedures you have. For example, I'm sure Lelia has informed you about her hepatitis Z condition and the serious risks associated with it. I was wondering how you disclose that to your other clients."
"Hepatitis?
Not to worry. Although there are, of course, no cures, the new drug therapies work wonders, and the side effects are fairly limited. Nausea, loss of hair, bloating, impotency, that sort of thing. In fact, death only occurs about half the time, if it's caught early enough."
Tom heard the phone drop, and then feet running away on Lelia's highly polished hardwood floors.
Then he listened as Lelia frantically called out, "Eric! Eric, where are you going? Eric, come back!"
After a door had slammed, Tom heard the phone being picked up. He could almost envision smoke pouring forth from the woman who had made Cuppy the magic beaver and Sassy the super squirrel the favorites of millions.
"What exactly did you say to him? And I mean exactly."
"We were just talking about my appointment and what I was expecting, and then he was gone."
"I distinctly heard him say hepatitis."
"Hepatitis? Lelia, I said gingivitis. I asked him if he had gingivitis because my old masseuse did, and I have to tell you, it was really not enjoyable, you know, breathing that really bad breath for an hour. I guess Eric's English isn't that good."
"I don't believe you, not for an instant, Tom Langdon. Do you realize what you've done? My back is killing me, and what about my toenails?"
"Perhaps Tylenol and an emery board?"
"This is not funny,"
she yelled. "Look, I'm beat, and the cell reception is bad here. I'll call you when we get into Pittsburgh."
"What? I thought you were in Pittsburgh."
Tom slapped his forehead at this gaffe. Under enormous pressure, he struck on what seemed a brilliant plan.
Lelia, he tapped the phone with his finger. "Lelia, you're breaking up. I can't hear you."
"Tom, don't you dare try to pull that."
He spoke slowly and in a very loud voice, as though to a hearing-impaired idiot.
"If you can hear me, I'll call you when we get into Chicago."
He clicked the off button and sat back. The phone rang again, but he didn't answer it. It went to voicemail, and then it rang again. He finally just turned it off. Well, that had gone reasonably okay. In his time, Mark Twain was probably the most often quoted person in America, and one of his famous sayings came from a miscommunication that had led the world to believe the great man had passed away. When asked to comment on his alleged demise, Twain had mischievously opined that the news of his death had been greatly exaggerated. Tom had a feeling that if he were unfortunate enough to be within Lelia's grasp right that minute, there'd be no one capable of over-embellishing the circumstances of his violent death. As the cap began to move, he settled back, turned off the light, and took up sentinel at the window. The train slowed once more, however, and as he squinted into the darkness, he could make out the tombstones of a small cemetery the train was now idling beside. Unnerved by the proximity of so many lost souls, Tom rose and went strolling once more. He had never done so much walking as he had since stepping foot on this train. Chapter 16. Tom poured a cup of coffee from the snack station near the stairs and headed for the lounge car. Most compartments were dark at this late hour, and he saw no one in the corridors. It could be him alone on this 10-car train chugging on. The dining room was also quiet and dark, the service crew long since having gone to their quarters in the dormitory car, he assumed. In the lounge area, the lights had also been turned down, and it was empty as far as he could tell. The train started up again, and he balanced himself against one of the seat backs. He recoiled when his hand touched skin, and he almost spilled his coffee. Eleanor looked up at him. She seemed as startled as he. She was also holding a cup of coffee.
"God," she said. "I didn't even hear you come in."
He eyed the coffee. Still have insomnia, too? They'd both suffered from it, perhaps because of too many time zones and too much travel, and too many horror stories covered that came back to torture them in their sleep. She rubbed her temples.
"Funny, I thought I was over it. It seems to have come back very recently."
"Okay, I get the hint. I can find another place to drink my coffee and mull my truly limitless future."
"No, I can leave," she said.
"Look," said Tom, "we're both adults. I think we can coexist on something as big as a train, at least for a little while."
"That's actually very mature of you."
"I have my moments." They were both silent as the cab picked up speed again, beating the tracks at nearly 80 miles an hour. Darkness had never flown by with such purpose, Tom thought.
"I've been wondering why you're really on this train," Eleanor said. "You were always into getting there the fastest way possible."
I told you I'm doing a story about a train trip, which is a little difficult to accomplish unless you actually ride one.
Is that all?
Why shouldn't it be?
Because I know you too well, I suppose. You don't have to tell me. It's not like you owe me an explanation.
He thought about the double meaning of that statement, as in, she didn't owe him an explanation either, but decided to let it pass. Instead, he told her about his father's wish and what he was doing about it, not that his dad would know.
I think maybe your father will know, she said quietly.
Okay, now, being the suspicious, paranoid, conspiracy theorist, investigative reporter type, I have to tell you, your being on this train seems like one heck of a coincidence.
We were supposed to be taking the Capital Limited yesterday.
She looked at her watch.
Well, since it's already tomorrow, I mean the day before yesterday. But then apparently Max's plans changed. He got into D.C. a day later, and we had to take the train you were on.
Tom shrugged. So, maybe it's a coincidence.
Trust me, if I'd known you'd be on this train, I wouldn't have been.
So it was really that bad, huh?
Look, we didn't work out. It happens to millions of people. Some folks just aren't the marrying kind.
I was married once. Eleanor was clearly stunned by this.
What?
Well, it was over so fast, the marriage, I mean, that I barely remember it.
Eleanor rose, her fury barely contained. Well, I'm glad you loved a woman enough to actually ask her however long it lasted.
Ellie, it wasn't like that. It was the worst decision of my life.
She turned and walked out.
He watched her leave as the cab came to a stop. He rose and leaned against the window. He said quietly to himself, "Actually, it was the second worst decision of my life." Then he said out loud, "What the hell is going on? I could have walked to Chicago faster."
"What is going on?" said a voice. "Is that a freight train is on the tracks up ahead, blocking the cab's way, that's what."
Tom looked in the direction the voice had come from. In the far corner of the lounge car, in the darkness, was the silhouette of a man. As the figure rose and seemed to float toward him, Tom thought he was about to encounter the ghost of Christmas Past, who was coming to foretell his future of doom. When the fellow came into the small wash of ambient light from the window, Tom let out his breath. He was tall in stature and lean, salt and pepper-haired, about 60 or so, with handsome, chiseled features. He clearly would have turned many a young lady's head in his prime. He was dressed in a white button-down shirt, tie, and dress slacks. He was also wearing what looked to be a conductor's cap.
"Do you work on the train?" asked Tom. He was looking at the man's hat. "No," he said, taking off his cap and shaking Tom's hand. "Although I used to. Retired now, name's Herrick Higgins."
Tom introduced himself and they sat down.
"You say there's a freight train up ahead? So why don't they get it to move out of the way?" "Well," said Higgins, "the easiest explanation is that Amtrak doesn't own the track. The freight company does, so freight takes priority over people."
"Are you serious?"
"Amtrak doesn't own any of the tracks it runs on, except along the Northeast Corridor and other bits here and there. When the private train companies gave up passenger rail, they weren't about to give up their tracks. You see, rail freight is very profitable. Hauling people isn't. Amtrak has arrangements with a whole hobgob of folks, and sometimes it's a logistical headache."
"No offense, but that doesn't sound like a great way to run a railroad," commented Tom.
"Amtrak was never appropriated the funds to either buy the tracks or build new ones. Its only choice was to deal with the owners. So if a freight train gets backed up or derails, we wait. Happens all the time, and we really can't do anything about it. Sorry, I keep saying we. Old habits die hard."
"How long were you with Amtrak?"
"Sometimes it seems like my whole life. I was actually around when it started up in 71. Been a railroad man since I took my first breath, just like my father was. He worked the UP, the Union Pacific."
Higgins looked at Tom's cup of coffee and smiled.
"Sleep comes slowly, if at all, on the first night on a train, but the second night you'll sleep through anything, trust me."
He looked out the window.
"This route is laid over what used to be a turnpike. George Washington owned stock in the Turnpike Company. I often wondered what the father of our country would say, seeing the old cap running up and down that same path. But maybe not much longer.
Future doesn't look too good for long-distance passenger trains. Government's talking about busting Amtrak up, privatizing, spinning off the Northeast Corridor.
Well, America's such a large country, train travel just doesn't make a lot of sense.
Higgins eyed him.
You're right. Train travel, as presently configured in this country, doesn't make a lot of sense. Amtrak folks are some of the most creative and dedicated souls there are. They have to be, to get by on shoestring budgets and running old equipment. They say rail travel is a financial drain. Well, I wonder what it's worth to the environment to get 10 million polluting cars off the highway, or a bunch of noisy jets from over the top of people's homes. Did you know that the United States spends more on cleaning roadkill off the highways than it does on passenger rail?
True, but passenger rail is subsidized. The airlines aren't.
Did the airlines build the airports? Do they pay for air traffic control? Fact is, the airlines have been given tens of billions of dollars by Uncle Sam, and they still barely make any money. The highways get over 80 cents out of every transportation dollar, and the result is we keep building roads, and we keep buying gas-guzzling cars to drive on those roads, and we're one big traffic jam and dependent on foreign oil. With just a 1-penny-per-gallon fuel tax fund, Amtrak could build a world-class passenger rail system, but the government won't give it to us. Ironically, this country was built by rail that connected the East to the West and made America the center of the world.
Higgins put his hat back on and adjusted it with a practiced hand.
I hear they're working on a commercial aircraft that will be able to fly 17,000 miles an hour. You could actually commute daily to Europe for work.
Well, that has appeal.
Oh, sure, if you're into the destination only as opposed to the trip itself. It's been my experience that most folk who ride trains could care less where they're going. For them, it's the journey itself and the people they meet along the way. You see, at every stop this train makes, a little bit of America, a little bit of your country, gets on and says hello. That's why trains are so popular at Christmas. People get on to meet their country over the holidays. They're looking for some friendship, a warm body to talk to. People don't rush on a train, because that's not what trains are for. How do you put a dollar value on that? What accounting line does that go on?
Higgins fell silent, rubbing his chin and looking at the floor.
I'm not saying that riding a train will change your life, or that passenger rail will be a big moneymaker one day, but no matter how fast we feel we have to go, shouldn't there be room for a train where you can just sit back, take a breath, and be human for a little while? Just for a little while. Is that so bad?
Chapter 17. As Tom left Herrick Higgins sitting there in the dark and walked slowly back to the sleeper cars, the cap started up again. Over the sounds of the rolling train, he heard something else, something that made him race down the hall and clamber down the stairs as he followed the source. There, sitting against one of the bulkheads, was Julie, sobbing, and Eleanor sitting next to her, her arms around the younger woman.
"What's going on?" asked Tom.
"I'm not sure," said Eleanor. "I just found her like this."
In a voice often halted by sobs, Julie explained that Steve's parents had called. They'd found out what the couple was planning and had threatened to both disown and disinherit Steve if he married Julie. Steve apparently hadn't been very decisive in telling them he was going ahead with it. In fact, he'd started to waffle so much that Julie and he had had a serious argument, and she'd fled her fiancé to cry her heart out.
"Where is he?" asked Tom.
She told him that Steve was back in his compartment.
"Take care of Julie. I'm going to see him."
"What are you going to do?" asked Eleanor.
"Stop him from making the mistake of his life."
Tom stalked off and soon found young Steve staring forlornly out the window of his compartment. For the next 10 minutes, he read the younger man the riot act, and voices and tempers flared on both sides until Tom finally asked, "Do you love her? Do you? It's really that simple."
"Yes,"
Steve said without hesitation.
"Then you take her without reservation, disclaimer, parental demands, or otherwise. You take her as she is with all her faults, weaknesses, idiosyncrasies, and requirements.
You take her without qualification, with no strings attached by anyone else, because that's what loving someone means. If you let that woman out of your life, you're a fool. She's given up as much as you, if not more. This may be the only shot you have at happiness. She may be the one woman in the entire world who you will love and who will make you happy. If you blow it, there's no going back. Steve, trust me. I love her, Tom. I really love her. Then that's all you need. That's all you need. Steve looked past him. Tom turned, and there was Eleanor and a red-faced Julie. They'd apparently heard pretty much everything. Julie flew to Steve's embrace. Tom stepped out and closed the privacy curtain. As he and Eleanor walked back, she said, "That was a good thing you did. I'm impressed." Why sit around and watch someone mess up his life? They were going through the darkened dining car when Eleanor gasped, screamed, and then pointed. Under one of the tables, two eyes were peering out at them. "What is that?" At that moment, a depressed-looking Cristobal came into the diner. When he saw Eleanor, he said, "God, Eleanor, I've been looking everywhere for you. Max is going to cut my salary. Can you talk to him?" "Why is he cutting your salary?" "Oh, because of a little misunderstanding about a pair of sunglasses I lost." "His?" "No, mine. They cost..." He looked where Tom was staring and screamed louder than Eleanor had. Jumping on one of the tables, he yelled out, "What is that?" Tom crept forward for a closer look. About the time he started to smile, Regina had come racing up in her robe. "What's going on now?" she asked. Tom was squatting in front of the table where the two eyes still peered out. "We have a visitor here, and I don't think it has a ticket." When Regina saw the two eyes, she drew back and clutched at her robe. "What is it?" "A stowaway of the reptilian variety. Do you have a flashlight, a cardboard box, or a styrofoam ice chest, and a spare blanket?" asked Tom. She ran off and was back shortly with an ice chest, blanket, and flashlight. Tom poked a couple of air holes in the chest, then shone the light under the table. That caused the creature to draw back in fear. Tom smiled. "Okay, Cristobal," he said. "Position yourself so that if it takes off, it won't get past you." Cristobal remained on the table. "Are you insane? I'm not getting anywhere near whatever that is." Tom looked at Eleanor. "Okay, okay," she said. "But I'm making no promises." She positioned herself at the other end of the car and looked at Tom expectantly. "Here we go," he said. Using the blanket, he was able to corral the critter and put it in the chest, but not without it almost getting away. Actually, it had made a beeline for Cristobal. The young man screamed so loudly it was now likely every citizen of Pennsylvania was fully awake. "What is it?" said Eleanor, who hadn't gotten a good look at it. "A boa constrictor, a young one, about 4 or 5 feet long, beautiful markings." Eleanor said, "I have several friends in L.A. who have them as pets." Cristobal just stared at her blankly. "This is a nightmare. All I wanted was my sunglasses and my same salary, and instead I'm almost killed by that thing." Eleanor smiled. "Cristobal, you love animals. You have a pet, too." "A Jack Russell Terrier, Eleanor. Don't you dare compare my little Hemingway to that serpent from hell." Eleanor said, "That's got to be somebody's pet. It's not like boa constrictors are indigenous to Pennsylvania." Tom agreed. "Probably got out of its cage and was scared to death." Regina said, "I guess I'll take charge of it and find out whose it is. Can't be too many people on board with a snake. At least I hope not." She didn't look too happy about taking the boa, thought Tom, and then he had a sudden brainstorm to rival anything Max Powers could come up with. "I'll tell you what, Regina, let me hold on to him for a bit while you check to see whose it is." "What are you going to do with it?" "There's a special friend on board I'd like to show it to." "Well, okay, but just don't let him loose." Tom looked over at Cristobal. "You can come down now." The man gingerly crept off the table. "You said you were looking for your sunglasses," said Tom. Cristobal nodded. "Well, my pen is missing, and so is Father Kelly's cross."
"My silver brush has disappeared too," said Eleanor.
"And Mr. Powers said his gold-plated money clip is gone too," added Cristobal.
And remember, that creep Merriweather is missing some stuff, added Tom. I think we do have a thief on board.
Regina rubbed her forehead.
Why me, Lord? Why me?
She wrapped her robe around her more closely and said,
Okay, I'll file a report with the Amtrak police when we get into Chicago. They'll probably need to talk to you. Get your statement, too. I'm sorry, this is pretty rare, I have to tell you. Most people leave valuables out all the time with no problem. I'm really sorry.
She wearily trudged off, and Eleanor said,
What are you going to do with the boa?
Tom smiled. I told you, show it to a special friend.
Who?
You'll see. Come on, Cristobal, we'll need you.
Look, I'm not getting in trouble over some snake. I never wanted to take the train in the first place. I mean, Mr. Powers has his own jet, for God's sake.
Tom said, Just do what I say, and it'll be fine. A few minutes later, outside Gordon Merriweather's compartment, someone peered in and saw that the lawyer was lying in the dark, solely in his underwear, his brief of choice being the blue bikini style. The man hadn't bothered to lock his door. Cristobal and Tom crept forward on their knees and placed the ice chest on its side. Tom had explained all about Merriweather to Cristobal, and he'd reluctantly agreed to help. Tom slowly opened the door and lifted the top off the chest. Both men heaved, and the boa went slithering into the compartment. Tom reached in, hit the switch by the sink, filling the room with bright light, and then slid the door closed. Cristobal had already fled before Merriweather screamed. Eleanor and Tom raced the other way and hid around the corner. They heard frantic banging on the door, and then it flew open, and Gordon Merriweather ran out. He fell, picked himself up, fell again, and then half rolled and half crawled down the hall. As soon as he was out of sight, Tom coaxed the snake back into the chest quite easily and passed it off to Cristobal. The poor reptile seemed traumatized by the sight of the paunchy lawyer in his indigo blue skivvies. Next, Tom and Eleanor raced off and caught up with the frantic Merriweather. When he turned, Eleanor let out a loud scream and covered her eyes.
That's him!
There's a thing, a snake, enormous in my room, yelled Merriweather.
He grabbed Tom's sleeve.
I'll show you. It's terrible. It almost killed me.
A snake on the train, said Tom skeptically. Regina came running up.
Now what's going on?
Tom said, This guy claims there's a snake in his room, that it almost attacked him. Out of Merriweather's line of sight, he gave her a wink. Regina caught the meaning immediately.
Eleanor said, I saw this man running by half naked. I think he looked in on me. I got this gentleman to come with me to see if we could catch him.
What? Said Regina. You mean like a peeping Tom?
Yes, it was terrifying. I thought he was completely naked.
Eleanor groaned and shuddered with the aplomb of a trained actress.
So that's what the other passengers have been complaining about, said Regina.
She turned to the stricken lawyer.
Just what in God's name do you think you're doing? You think because you're some big shot you can run around nearly naked and peep in on women and scare them? Do you? Well, if you do, let me tell you, you don't want to mess around with Amtrak. And when we get to Chicago, you're going to find out why not.
Merriweather sputtered.
I...
Tom pulled out a notepad and pen. Is that Merriweather just like it sounds? And can I get the exact name of your law firm?
There was a snake in my room, wailed Merriweather. I'm no streaker. I'm not a pervert.
Streaker and pervert. Those were exactly the words I was looking for, said Tom as he wrote furiously.
I'll show you. I'll show you.
Merriweather pulled them down the hallway to his compartment, as it turned out, his completely empty compartment. Merriweather yelled.
It was here. I swear. At least I think it was.
Were you sleeping? Asked Eleanor.
Well, yes, and then the light woke me up.
Maybe you left the light on, fell asleep, and you just dreamed about a snake. Did you ever think of that? Said Eleanor. Merriweather looked at her with an expression that said, no, he hadn't really thought of that. Regina said,
You've disrupted this whole train. I'm calling the conductor. He'll probably want to turn you over to the police in Pittsburgh.
No, no, screamed Merriweather. That will ruin my reputation, my law practice.
You should have thought about that before you started running around scaring people with those skinny marshmallow legs, said Tom.
Please, please, I'll do anything, anything.
Regina, Eleanor, and Tom looked at each other.
Well, it is Christmas, said Tom, after a lengthy silence broken only by the whimpering litigation virtuoso.
Regina tapped her foot and, giving Meriwether a look of immense disgust, pointed her finger in his face.
Okay, fine. It's late and I'm tired. But let me tell you one thing, lawyer man. If I ever have one more moment's trouble with you ever, your butt is in the fire. You understand me? This all comes out. You got it? Absolutely, absolutely.
He looked pitifully at Tom and his notepad. Tom very slowly put it back in his pocket.
Okay, but just because it is Christmas. But remember, I can write this story at any time, and I've got witnesses, okay?
Yes, yes, I understand. Okay.
Regina snapped. Now get some clothes on.
Meriwether raced inside his compartment and slid the door shut.
Okay,
said Regina as she ceremoniously tapped Tom and Eleanor on the shoulders.
You're now officially honorary members of the Capital Limited Club. I don't know exactly how you brought that man down, but I've been waiting a long time to see it.
Hey, said Tom, all you need is a boa constrictor, some accomplices, and a 12-million-pound train. Mix and bake.
A bit later, Regina located the owners of the snake and returned it, with instructions to keep it under wraps for the rest of the trip and say nothing about its presence on the train. As Tom and Eleanor walked back to their compartments, he chuckled.
That felt like old times. Remember all the practical jokes we pulled when we were overseas and things were slow and we were bored?
No, I remember all the practical jokes you played, and I don't remember being bored very much. Overstimulated was more like it.
He stopped, and so did Eleanor. Come on, you have to admit it was great, wasn't it?
It was different, was as far as Eleanor would go. He said hesitantly,
You know, I'm taking this trip not just for my dad, but to sort of find out where I'm supposed to be going with my life.
Let me guess, you're leaning more towards Yemen than Duncan Fife.
I guess it's in some people's blood to roam. I could never be happy looking at the same four walls all the time.
Or the same person inside those four walls.
Look, are you telling me you didn't have the time of your life doing what we did?
It was fine for a while. Then it wasn't fine anymore. Fine? I can count on one hand the number of people who've gotten to do and see what we did. Look at the stories you have to tell your kids and grandkids.
I don't have either.
If it was so damn bad, why'd you stick it out for so long?
You know what they say, love makes you do crazy things.
I still don't know what went wrong. It's not like I suddenly changed.
No, Tom, you never changed. I guess I did.
Good night.
Ellie!
She turned back.
It's Eleanor now.